Clean Simple Eats is a rapidly growing health and wellness company committed to elevating lives through food, fitness, and the best tasting supplements on the planet. The brand takes pride in offering clean, all-natural ingredients with zero artificial flavors and sweeteners. From their TikTok viral protein powders to their delicious super greens mixes and other supplements, every product is non-GMO, third-party tested, and comes in a variety of drool-worthy flavors. Fuel your body and transform your life. Shop Clean Simple Eats supplements.
You're listening to the Utah Checkdown Podcast. And now your hosts, Josh Furlong and Josh Newman.
Welcome back to another edition of the Utah Checkdown Podcast. I am Josh Furlong, joined as always with my co-host Josh Newman. Josh, how are we feeling this rainy Thursday morning? Morning. We're still morning. Yep.
Really tired, but this weather, we've talked about this before. Like, I was always a summer guy. Like, my whole life I was a summer guy. And then something about this past summer, I think, broke me. And I would rather it be a little overcast, a little gray, a little rain. Maybe that says something about my mental health, but this is what I'm like into right now. So I'm a little tired, but like the weather is speaking to me. So I'm into it.
So basically you want to live in Seattle in perpetuity, right?
My wife certainly would. And if we could work that out one day, I would definitely get on board.
You know, I have to say, like, going to Seattle, every time I go up there, it's just a great city. It's like, it's funny. I can't remember where I was at. I was either at a restaurant or it was in the hotel. And one of the people there said, it's the smallest big city that you'll ever be a part of. Like, it's just like got that small town feel, but it's still a massive metropolis, you know, but it's great. Like, there's everything about it is great. The vibe is great. The feel in the air is great. It's just perfect. So if I didn't ever live in Utah, I would probably want to live in Seattle if I could afford it, which I can't. So it's a pipe dream.
Yeah, no, the vibes are awesome. And look, if anybody listening out there has never been to Seattle, like, all of these little different, you know, enclaves and neighborhoods in Seattle proper, once you get into downtown, like, my wife grew up out in the suburbs,
okay,
like 20 minutes from Seattle proper. But when we go to Seattle, like, obviously we were in Seattle over the weekend for the Washington game, and like, each little neighborhood has its own vibe and its own great restaurants and its own great, you know, bars, if you're into that sort of thing. Like, Seattle is very much a hidden gem of a city, because, right, it's tucked away in the Pacific Northwest, and maybe you don't think about it like some other big cities in the United States. But if you've never been to Seattle, I would make an effort to at least do a long weekend, something. The place has a lot to offer, and personally, I really, really enjoy every trip I take to Seattle.
I echo that, even though I haven't spent as much time up there as you, but I love it. I need to take my family up there next time and spend some time up there and just enjoy it. It's a nice, relaxing vibe, so I'll take that. So let's jump into football. We've got football back this Saturday, obviously, as Utah wraps up its road conference slate. They have one more game at home, obviously, but they're traveling on the road to Arizona. And, we'll get into that in a second, but I want to kind of point out something that the Pac-12 sent us yesterday, and it's I'm titling it "So You're Telling Me There's a Chance," and this is essentially five teams in the Pac-12 that still mathematically have a chance to make it to the Pac-12 title game. Utah is included in that, and I don't know the official odds. It's probably got to be around 1%, maybe lower.
Very, very low.
Very, very low. Very, very low. I have not done my flowchart this year. I've actually had a million people text me or DM me about it. We'll see. I don't know, man. Like, these last few weeks have been busy, but the Pac-12 is here for the rescue, and they gave us some stuff. Obviously, Washington and Oregon, you win, essentially you're in. Washington, if they win and Utah beats Arizona, they're a lock. It's still crazy that even with the win over Oregon State, Utah still has to beat Arizona for that to be a lock, but that's there. Oregon has a few more things that have to go its way, mostly beating Oregon State. Arizona, they have to beat Arizona State. There's these different things there. Utah, my favorite, though, is to stay in contention, they have to beat Arizona and have both Washington beat Oregon State and Arizona State beat Oregon. So just like we planned, everything's going to happen. Welcome to your third Pac-12 championship. Get your tickets to Las Vegas ready. No, you're not buying that.
You know what? Let's just like go along with this hypothetical. Okay. For the people that are unaware, the Pac-12 championship game, which is at Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas, I think the capacity for the Pac-12 title game is like 62 or 64,000, somewhere in there. That game sold out like real early, yeah, like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I'm assuming it sold out that early because it became clear that like Washington and Oregon were on a collision course for the Pac-12 title game. It would be the height of hilarity if everything broke right, Utah somehow got back to Vegas, and the place is sold out, and you've got all of these Utah fans going to the secondary market and the Washington fans or Oregon fans like dumping their tickets, and that would be quite a scene. It's not going to happen, but again, in a hypothetical world, that would be very, very funny if Utah somehow got there and then everybody's scrambling on 6 days' notice trying to find flights and planning to drive and the whole thing.
Outside of Oregon State winning the whole thing, this becomes a nightmare for George Kliavkov, right? Like, he has to give a trophy to a team that basically said, no, we'll see you later. I mean, we assume it's Washington and Oregon, and I don't imagine that not to be the case, even though Washington...
We're very much heading towards a Washington-Oregon.
Exactly. And so that's two Big Ten teams now, essentially being right. able to... They're the ones that cannibalized the conference, that at least the latest round, right? Everybody was kind of hinging on Oregon. Oregon said, yeah, we're up. Nope, we're done. And it fell apart. The fact that the possibility that Kliavkov, if he doesn't punt the task, which I wouldn't be surprised if he did, the fact that he has to deliver that is I don't know if it's poetic justice. It's more just, I don't even know what you'd call it. It's just sad reality, maybe. Maybe that's what it is. Yeah. And I don't know. It's crazy. I don't know. We've gone over this a few times in some of our episodes of just like, if the Pac-12 had stayed together for six more months, would they be in this situation? If they could have found a way to, you know, existed past this season, right, would the Pac-12 still be alive? You know, the Pac-2 is still fighting in court, and right now Oregon State and Washington State have their ruling, and there's an injunction or a stay right now, so it's not quite there. But there's a chance that those two teams are ruling the funds of the Pac-12 and potentially merging with the Mountain West Conference, as we heard today from Ross Dellinger and right, a few other people. So I don't know. It's just a weird turn of events. And no matter what happens, whether it's Utah, it's not going to be Utah. I'm just going to say that. But, you know, whoever is in that Pac-12 championship game, it's going to be a surreal feeling being able to see, you know, who comes out on top and then seeing the trophy being lifted for the last time before these teams essentially go their way.
Yeah, it's sad, you know, and we've talked about this, and I don't want to go like too far off the rails, but like, I'm genuinely going to miss like Pac-12 After Dark. You know, I learned to love it. And I just remember even on like Saturday, right? Like Utah, Washington was early, wrote that, grabbed some dinner, went back to my in-laws, did some more writing, and I'm staying up late to like watch like USC, Oregon. And I was up until 12:30, and it was just like a lot of fun between that game and the discourse on Twitter during the late Pac-12 game. And it's just, you know, it's a lot of fun, and it's a shame that it's going away because we're probably not going to have anything like that moving forward. I don't think you're going to get to a point where it's like a Big 12 After Dark. And if there is some semblance of a Big 12 After Dark, it's not going to be the calamity and the hilarity that Pac-12 After Dark has provided us for many, many years.
If any conference has the ability to do it, it will be the Big 12. Maybe the ACC, based on kind of their wonkiness lately. But could you imagine the Big 10 or the SEC trying to, like, that just, none of that, that just computes.
It's unnatural. Like, there's a reason why, you know, the Big 10 doesn't play on Thursdays. You get the occasional Friday Big 10 game. You never get any of that with the SEC because it's unnatural.
Yep.
And those conferences believe, probably rightfully so, that they are beyond such things. So the, you know, the weirdness is left to the Pac-12. And yeah, I wish it could have stayed together. There's plenty of blame to go around, which we've been over. And I'm sure we're going to, you know, write the epilogue of the Pac-12 at some point once the regular season ends, maybe once bowl season ends. But it is, you know, it's genuinely sad that it's all coming to an end because it's been a lot of fun.
Speaking of weird, not having CBS on with the SEC is going to be quite the experience. Hearing that music in the
Big Ten, already weird. Like is. Big Ten football on CBS. Ohio State Rutgers was a noon game on CBS. It's unnatural. It makes no sense. But we're all going to have to get used to it because it's not changing.
It's college football, and that's what we love about college football. It's just chaotic. It's crazy. Yep. It's drunk. That's really what it comes down to.
Doesn't make a lot of sense too much of the time, which is part of the fun.
Exactly. I love it. Well, let's jump into this game on Saturday. Obviously, Utah travels to Tucson, where they will take on Arizona. And it's funny because anybody that's watched this game, you know, or at least has watched Arizona, knows that Jed Fish has been able to kind of build, right? Like, I think last year they were still picked pretty low in the preseason poll. I remember being like one of the first, at least on Twitter, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, but like trying to say, like, watch out for Arizona. They're going to be much better than you expect. And they were, and they weren't anything like outlandish or anything like that, but they were better, right? I think we're starting to see this as a team that is completely growing into what Jed Fish wants it to be. This is a team that is pretty remarkable. They've found a way to be able to really overcome a recruiting deficit that they've had for the last probably 10 plus years. Maybe it's not quite that long. I obviously don't follow recruiting as much to kind of speak to that, but
most
it hasn't
of
been
the
good.
Last 10 to 15 years.
Exactly. I mean, this
for sure.
This just hasn't been a destination where a lot of the top end recruits they hit occasionally, but their coaching problems that they've had, you know, it just hasn't worked out for them. And so this has been a tough destination, and yet Jed Fish has got it going. So, you know, you go into this game and beginning of this season, it still looked like a tough game, but not the game that it is now, right? I think it was John Wilner who tweeted, he said, who would have thought that the Washington-Arizona stretch would have been the toughest back-to-back game or games in the Pac-12 this season? And he's right. I mean, this becomes a very tough stretch. For me, where I'm kind of pointing to this is Utah going to have an emotional letdown based on where they were at against Washington? They were beaten down after that game. Like you yes. saw the emotions of the players. Even Kyle yep. Whittingham, who always talks quiet, talked even quieter. He took it to a lower level. You know, yeah. this was a loss that absolutely hurt them. So is there going to be an emotional letdown? Kyle has kind of kept his team in sync and keeps them up, you know, but they've always had something to play for, especially since 2017. Do you think there can be an emotional letdown, or do you expect an emotional letdown going into this game?
Yeah, I mean, just based on what we've seen in the past, not just like the last few years, but just like the last few weeks, maybe the last couple of seasons, but like Utah generally responds well off a loss. And Kyle does a good job of, well, not just Kyle, but really this is a time where he leans on his captains. And he leans on the leadership council to take control of the locker room. And everybody needs to circle the wagons and understand that there's more football to play. Now, you bring up an interesting point. You know, it's November 16th. Utah has not been in this position where they are not playing for a berth in the Pac-12 championship game since, if you take out the COVID season, they have not been in this position since 2017. It's been a long time since Utah had, you know, nothing to play for. And you don't want to say nothing, right? There's games to play, but nothing meaning like you're not going to the conference championship game. So I think that's a primary storyline, you know, going into this thing on Saturday is what does Utah look like? Is there an emotional letdown? Do they play, you know, do they play down to the belief that there's nothing left to play for? Or again, does Kyle and the captains and the leadership council, do they, you know, does everybody get back on board at least for a good showing of pride? Okay. That you at least have two more games to play. Look, I'll say this. Utah can absolutely lose to this Arizona team. Like this Arizona team has been very, very good for the last 6 weeks as Noah Fifita has, you know, sort of been a revelation, right? Taking over for quarterback for Jaden Delora, I believe in early October. So Utah can absolutely lose to this team. But I think in terms of optics, I think it would look pretty bad if big, bad, mighty Utah lost to Arizona. Like, that's not a game that you generally should be losing. Now, look, again, Arizona's played well. Utah's coming off a loss, right? The emotional letdown. But yeah, I think from an optics standpoint, I don't think it would look very good if Utah lost this game. And I certainly don't think it would look good if Utah lost, but if Arizona like dominated play. You know what I was thinking about was back in 2021, right? Of course, both of these teams are radically different than they were in 2021. Mm-hmm. But Jed Fish was in year two, I think, in 2021. And he was just starting to like try to get it cranked up to his liking. And nobody played Utah tougher down the stretch of that 21 season.
It's true.
Than Arizona. If you like look at Utah's season, nobody played Utah tougher than Arizona. You know, Utah was up like 31-29, like midway through the fourth quarter. Arizona had missed a 2-point conversion. Utah like woke up and like looked like a championship outfit between like, you know, rising converted third down a couple of times. There was a fourth down in there. TJ Pledger was awesome in that fourth quarter. Nobody played Utah tougher. Nobody made them earn it more down the stretch in 21 than Arizona. So I think that's something to just keep in mind that like you kind of thought then that like, okay, Jed Fish might have this going in the right direction. And it hasn't been like quickly for everything that you've said, right? The recruiting deficiencies and whatever else, but like slow incremental process. There's been a lot of patience from the Arizona athletic department and the Board of Regents and the whole thing. And if you look at Arizona season, they're 7-3. Not every 7-3 season is made equally, but you look at who they've lost to. I mean, the losses are good. Like you lost to Washington by 7. You lost to USC by 2, a game that frankly, Arizona should have won. It went to overtime. They certainly did enough to win. So it's highly intriguing. I definitely remember like early in the season thinking, I probably said this out loud at least once, like a trip to Arizona is no longer like the automatic check mark for Utah that it used to be. And we're seeing that sort of play out now, okay, with the season that Arizona has had. The spread opened at a straight pick 'em. It's kind of hovering around there now, like depending on which book you trust. Arizona's a 1.5-point favorite against Utah. So very, very interested to see what Utah looks like and how engaged they are knowing that there's no conference title game coming.
Yeah, and I think you have to look at this from the perspective of the players, right? Like, they're not going into this, you know, expecting to lose, and they want to win every single game, and it doesn't matter necessarily that the Pac-12 championship is off the table. They're playing for pride, right? Some of them playing for family. Some of them are playing for better opportunities. Some of them maybe even playing for better transfer opportunities because there's some guys that, you know, they're not going to be long-term plans for Utah, but they're trying to play for themselves into another team. So you don't really know the motivation of players. And look, you can look at it. You can say, for example, Arizona State, they found out right before their season started that they were ineligible for a bowl. Right. And they could have just meld in the season. They could have said, look, we're not going to do anything. And yet Arizona State continues to fight. They're beating teams that they shouldn't beat. They're staying engaged. They're staying motivated. That to me speaks to a good coach. Right. That's where Kyle has taken this program. Right. That doesn't mean Utah can't lose this game. As you mentioned, Utah can absolutely lose this game. They can lose it by double digits. Arizona is a very solid team. And we can maybe break down a little bit of that here in a second. But this is what Kyle has done. He's tried to promote a program that teaches his players that, look, it's not about the results necessarily. It's about how you would do individually and how you perform and the culture and everything around that kind of stuff. So, like you mentioned, Utah doesn't generally perform poorly outside of a loss. They can still lose back-to-back games. That's not the situation here. But I think you're going to see some fight. I think you're going to see some guys that are trying to prove something. You know, for example, Bryson Barnes, this may be the last season he gets to start as a quarterback, right? I don't know. I don't know what his future is. I don't know if he's going to stay at Utah, if he stays as a backup, if he stays what. But, like, he's got to look to his future. You can't tell me that Bryson Barnes isn't going to go out there and fight. You can't tell me that some of these players on the line or some of these receivers aren't going to go out there and try to make something. Devon Vele, if he still has intentions on the NFL and he wants to leave this year, like we mentioned last podcast, he has to continue to perform, right? So there's a lot of motivations there. There's a lot of things that are going in Utah's favor in that regard, in the sense that they have to look forward. Look, they're not overlooking Arizona to play Colorado, to play in the Pac-12 championship game like that 2021 season, right? Utah completely overlooked Arizona. They didn't expect to play them that tough. Arizona took it, and they, you know, play them really tough, and Utah got away with the win in the end. But, like, at this point, now it's about pride. And that sounds kind of weird based on Utah only losing three games to top 10 teams, but, like, it is about pride. It's about improving your stock. It's improving, you know, where you want to be and all those things. It's about finishing, really, what it comes down to. So can an emotional letdown take place? 100%. And I think it's, you know, in the realm of possibility. But I think you're going to look at this team that's resolved. They're going to come in. They're frustrated. They want to get back, and they want to put something else on tape so they don't have to look back at that Washington loss where they look back and say, look, we did nothing in that second half. So it's still going to be a tough game. This one is really intriguing to me. I actually view this game very similarly to Oregon State, and as I've gotten into the stats a little bit, this is what rings true, right? These teams are kind of they're not the exactly similar teams, but I think the kind of the optics going into this is a team that is trying to prove that they belong. This is a team that has a lot of talent, and they can absolutely beat you in different ways that Oregon State does. And, you know, a lot of people look at this type of opponent as a trap type opponent. Now, Utah's not in a scenario where this is a trap opponent, but that's kind of the vibe that I'm getting. I'm kind of sensing that Oregon State vibe in a different kind of way, but I don't know. What do you think? Do you think this is kind of along those lines, or how do you view this game going into the desert?
I don't know. It's like I don't disagree with anything you said, but I just don't know. I just don't know what we're gonna get. And, like, you know, I didn't mean to say like that guys weren't gonna fight and that, you know, that guys weren't gonna play hard.
You're saying it right now.
Sorry, guys. but yeah, I do think that the potential for an emotional letdown, like I think that's a real thing, and the fact that there is not going to be a conference title game berth, I think that's a real thing too. I mean, I think that it's harder nowadays, as we all know, to kind of insulate everything and keep out the outside noise. Like 15, 20 years ago, like that was very possible because, you know, the internet was still sort of young and social media was not a thing. And, you know, guys were at the facility. They were not like around campus, like regular students. Now it's different. Like guys have social media, guys know, those players are very aware of what fans are saying. Certainly of what some media is saying. You can't insulate everything anymore. So how much are you buying into that? How much is that on your mind? Not that you're going to mail it in, but how much do you buy into the notion of the season is quote unquote over, right? It's not over technically, but in terms of what is still possible, in terms of what your preseason goals were, the season is over. So I don't know. I don't quite know what to make of this matchup. Who's going to be more engaged? Look, the winner of this game still has a shot at 9 regular season wins and 10 wins, including a bowl game.
Yeah.
If you win 10 games, I mean, that's a successful season. If you win 9 regular season games, like, let me ask you, I personally think 9-3 sounds better than 8-4.
Oh, yeah.
Is that crazy?
No, I completely think that.
Like, you guys were 9-3. That sounds better, more decisive. More just sounds better than 8-4.
No, you're not wrong. I mean, I think 8-3 sounds like 7-5. I think that's very similar, right? Like it sounds like you tried and failed at the end. Like 7-5 is ultimately like, yeah, you didn't do great. But 8-3 feels much more of like a disappointing season than 9-3. 9-3, if you can finish 9-3 with all three of your losses coming against, you know, top 10 teams, one of those teams is going to be out of the top 10 based on how they have to play each other.
Right.
But I think the fact that you can kind of hang your hat on that, and once again, we're not going to go into the moral victory realm, but the fact that you can hang your hat on 9-3 with the potential to get a 10th in a bowl game, and bowl games are always tricky, and you know, if you don't win that 10th, so be it. But I think that's the crazy thing, like how that momentum can shift and how you can feel about your program if you can just get to that 9th win. That's to me how important that 9th win is, especially you can go back and say, look, we beat the odds because the odds makers were saying the games that we were going to win were 8 this year. If you can get to 9, you're making progress. You're doing that against one of the toughest schedules that you've ever had. You're doing that with literally 10-plus players with season-ending injuries and others banged up. JaQuindon Jackson, for all intents and purposes, should be a season-ending injury. Van Fillinger should be a season-ending injury.
Jaquan should have been done weeks ago.
Exactly. Like, these are players that are still playing, and they should have been lost for a while. So, look, if you can get to 9-3, by all means, you have to think this is a successful season.
Yeah, I agree. And we've kind of tiptoed around this, and I suspect that if Utah wins this weekend to get to 8-3 and they're looking at potentially 9-3, I suspect that at least the two of us are going to start asking Kyle Whittingham some questions about, you know, context and is this a successful season? And I remember we did that last year, right? They lost to Oregon and the chances of the Pac-12 championship game were like waning, right? They needed all the help. And I very much remember, like, you and I were asking that Monday after the Oregon loss with them at 8-3, like, is this a successful season if you get to 9-3? And you have to consider what last year was, right? With Rising's knee after USC, Tavion Thomas, that was a mess.
That was Brand a mess. Keith.
Oh my Brand gosh. Keith, he was out for the year in late September. A lot of things went on with that particular Utah team. So the prospect, at least to me, the prospect of getting to 9-3 and no Pac-12 championship game, that struck me as a successful season. Now, we all know what happened, right? They beat Colorado. They got the help. They went to Vegas. Fine. I'm going to have the same questions on Monday if Utah wins this game at Arizona to get to 8-3, looking at potentially 9-3. What does Kyle think about a potential 9-win season against the backdrop of everything that has gone on with Rising and Keithy and Lander Barton and Logan Fano and Jaquindon Jackson and Junior Tafuna missed time early, Samote Pepe missed time early, Connor O'Toole didn't debut until like early October? A lot has gone on here. So yeah, if you get the 9 wins, pretty good season. Not what you wanted. It's not going to end the way you want it, but you have to view it as a positive and optimistic. And you'll come off a 9-win season. And I think we're in a spot now where, and I mentioned this in the mailbag, which is up on KSL.com right now, you're in a position where Rising coming back is now like very much in play.
Yeah.
If you win 9 games and your recruiting class is looking really good right now, take the 9 wins, the recruiting class, we're going to sit here and assume cautiously at this point that Rising is coming back. You could be in a lot worse position than what Utah is now coming down the stretch here, knowing what you have coming back, going into a new conference where if Rising does come back, you're going to go into the Big 12, maybe not as like the media coach's favorite, but you're going to go into the Big 12 with real legitimate aspirations to win that conference in 2024.
I thought you did a good job kind of painting that picture. And I kind of want to ask this question based off all of that. If Utah loses this weekend, does the odds of them losing against Colorado increase in your mind? Or do you still kind of paint those as two isolated points in this season? Or do you think a loss this week changes the trajectory next week?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, my instinct is like they're two separate entities. Like Arizona's this week, Colorado's next week. They're two different things. You have to separate them. But again, like going back to what I was saying, like let's say you lose to Arizona and you're still sort of in this position where like, okay, you have no momentum and let's say that game is at night. It's Thanksgiving weekend. You're not playing for much. The crowd, I assume for a night game like that, is not going to be great. So that's a good question. I'd feel more comfortable like really like diving into that after we see what this Arizona game looks like. But like on the surface, in a vacuum, like you in a perfect world, you would like to think that they're just two separate entities. Like whatever happens at Arizona, that's at Arizona, and it has nothing to do with what happens versus Colorado, but maybe that's a little bit naive. But either way, let's see what happens versus Arizona first.
My gut agrees with you in the sense that they're two isolated games that I don't think have true bearing on each other. But with that said, depending on, if Utah goes into Tucson and they lose in a demoralizing way, that's where I think it shifts, right? I think that's where it kind of, builds on each other. I don't even necessarily view this Washington and Arizona game as kind of a combination. I think they are two also isolated points. I think the backdrop of Washington obviously maybe is a little more fresh, and that one was much more demoralizing just because where Utah was at, top five team in the country, you had the lead, you really had a chance to win that game, you know, yada, yada, yada. But I still don't know that that fully translated into this week. But with that said, I think if you do that now against Arizona and you're not able to get it done and you do it in a way which is demoralizing, that's to me where it becomes a little bit more tricky. Now, granted, it's senior night and it's Colorado, and you can say what you want about that. But, yeah, I don't know that they're all kind of tied in together. It just depends on how the season progresses. And that's the crazy thing is, like, you know, we sat here and we just said, if they can get to 9-3, that sounds like a successful season. But 7-5 is absolutely on the table, which is completely demoralizing to where Utah started this season. So I don't know. It's kind of a wild situation.
If they not only lose to Arizona, but if they get like beat up, like if they get like thoroughly outplayed and they lose this game by like two scores, you're going to have to like really think about sitting down Jaquindon Jackson.
Oh, for sure.
For Colorado. And anybody else who is like banged up or has been like dealing with something, you're going to have to sit some guys down. And that's another kind of topic of conversation that like if you get handled by Arizona, is it time to sit guys down? And then if it is time to sit guys down, what are you doing with those guys for the bowl game? Because if you're not playing against Colorado, what are you playing in the bowl game for? You know, the bowl game at that point becomes a bit of a controlled scrimmage. And, you know, if you think back to the Vegas Bowl last year where Oregon State, you know, pounded Florida, Florida sat a million guys. And guys had hit the portal and anybody who was hurt was just not playing. So, you know, bowl season tends to get a little weird if you're not playing in a New Year's Six game or you're not playing in a CFP semifinal. These games are just not, and this is a whole nother topic, but like these games are just not worth it. And guys opting out, I don't fault anybody for opting out for any reason, whether it's injury, you're going to the NFL, you want to preserve health. So that's going to be, I think no matter what happens here with these last two games, I think that's going to be like very much a thing at Utah, is at least not necessarily guys like opting out, but I think there's going to be a lot of guys who are at least thinking about that. Because again, as you said, Utah has not been in this position in many years where you're just not playing for anything in mid-November. So I think there's a lot of moving parts around Utah football as we head down the stretch here. And a lot of moving parts for the first time in a very long time, and a situation that we have not seen in a very long time. And I'm interested to see how guys handle it. I sit here right now and I don't know. Like, I don't know who's going to opt out, but I mean, we could rattle off, excuse me, we could rattle off 6, 8, 10 guys who should be at least thinking about opting out of a bowl game. We're not going to do that because it's not fair, but these are real things and like real decisions that are going to have to be made here soon.
And to that point, you gave a good answer in the mailbag talking about who at least two of those players should and could be, you know, but I think the way that this season has gone, I don't know that there is a huge push to have a lot of these guys sit, right? I think that just based on the injuries and different things, if a guy is sitting, it is based on injury, in my opinion. I don't know that there's that many that would sit like Clark Phillips did in the Rose Bowl to, you know, project the NFL dream.
No,
and everything.
I don't think you have a lot of guys like that. But like Clark Phillips at one point was like a projected first round pick, maybe early second round pick. So that was kind of like its own deal. Like if you're a projected first round pick, even if it's the Rose Bowl, like you're giving real credence, real thought to like maybe sitting. You know, Cole Bishop, who, you know, again, in the mailbag, somebody asked me about, you know, who could potentially sit. I think Cole Bishop is like the number one option just because, again, he's got the highest draft stock of anybody on the roster, but he's not a first-round guy, and maybe he's not even a second-round guy. He's a day two guy, I think, second, third round, but he's not a guy where, you know, he's not going to be drafted high enough where you really have to consider sitting out. Now, again, I don't know. Maybe, you know, his parents and his inner circle in conjunction with Kyle and Morgan Scally, maybe they decide, okay, he's going to sit. I don't know, but that is, to me, Cole Bishop is the number one guy who you think of immediately in terms of Utah guys who may opt out of a bowl game.
And honestly, there's no guarantee that it's going to help you, as you saw with Clark Phillips, right? I think going into the Rose Bowl, we all assumed he was at least a day one, if not day two guy in the second round. You know, he was preserving his stock. He was trying to do these different things to be able to add to that. And then he falls, if I remember correctly, to the fourth round. I mean, there's no guarantee. And so let's say that a Cole Bishop does try to do that, or he's at least considering it. With that in recent memory, he has to look at that. What can I do in a bowl game potentially that can help there? And look, we're still a couple weeks out from this, but I think the point being made, there's still so much up in the air. I don't know that there's that many players preserving their stock for the NFL. If anything, it is more preserving it for health. You know, I could see somebody like a Van Fillinger preserving his health just so that he has another chance to potentially play next season.
No, you're right. This particular team, you know, the concept of opting out I completely agree with you, is geared more towards injury than draft stock. In fairness, Clark Phillips was dealing with some injury stuff that did not really get out there, like, late in the season. That was, like, very, very well kept by certain people. Clark Phillips was hurt, like, down the stretch. So that was part of why he opted out. But no, to your point, I do agree with you. Any sort of opt-outs, the vast majority of that stuff on this particular Utah team would be geared towards injury, getting healthy versus draft stock. I don't know that this particular Utah team is going to have a ton of draft picks. Even if guys left early, I'm going through it, like, small handful.
Yeah.
Small handful of guys would be drafted off this team, if that.
Yeah, and I think that's why you're going to potentially see a lot of these guys return next year. I know that's hard. We've gotten into this, but I think it's a difficult situation for these guys because they don't want to be too old when they go to the NFL, but they also want to put their best foot forward. I don't know that any player on Utah outside of maybe a handful put enough on tape to be able to give themselves an opportunity to be in the NFL draft. So, yeah, we'll see what happens and see how it shakes out. There's always some guys that surprise you. I think somebody like a TJ Pledger surprised us when he decided to leave because, you know, he did enough on tape, but not enough to really justify him going to the NFL. But, you know, guys want to do what they want to do, and they want to also try to get to the professional ranks and not be in school. So let's move on to Arizona, obviously. And we jumped around them a little bit and talked about how good they are. But let's kind of break them down a little bit. You and I are not the guys that are going to get into the tape and are going to break down and why they hit the A gap this way and why they hit the B gap that way. So,
can we call Bartle?
He'll geek out on you on offensive line play and
geek out on linemen.
And we can talk some of the linemen stuff here. I've got it as a talking point if we need to. So, but just looking at this, how this team is kind of crafted. Noah Fifita took over from Jaden Delora. Noah Fifita is a freshman. He's not the biggest guy, but he's got a strong arm. He also can be a dual threat quarterback, but he's not really at the same time. He doesn't have a lot of rushing yards to his name, but he can be mobile in the pocket to kind of extend the play. This is a pass first-ish type team. They rank 25th in the country, so it's not quite like the Oregons or Washingtons or USC's even to that point. But they're a good team, and they're going to push it down the field, and they're going to try to make some big chunk plays. They're not as good in the run game. Think USC, that's kind of where they're at. They're 67th in the country, so they've got enough to be able to beat you, and they can do things in the ground game, but it's not something that's going to be prolific. So where does that leave Utah? You know, I mean, I think that they've done enough in the last few games, and you can look to that Washington game to say, look, Utah has the guys to be able to compete against a pass heavier team, I guess you could say. You know, Roma Dunze is not on Arizona. Jacob Cowing is, and he's a good player, but he's not Roma Dunze. And so I think there's things that play into Utah's strength here, but it's still not, it's not their natural strength in a team that's going to run the ball more. So that's kind of where Utah's at. Defensively, they're pretty stout. You know, they hold the run game down pretty well. They're 14th in the country. They've limited only 99 yards per game. Passing, they're equally as impressive at 52nd. So this is a good team. They're not quite as well balanced as Oregon, I would say. But this is a team that can absolutely make Utah pay. And if Utah is not hitting on its, you know, offensive schemes or the defense is kind of missing tackles or doing different things like that, you know, Arizona and Noah Fifita is absolutely going to beat them. So, you know, you got to watch this game. This is a sneaky good game for Arizona in the sense that they can do a lot of good things and absolutely torch Utah. But with that being said, I don't I don't know that they're, you know, I don't know if going into this game, me objectively looking at this, if I would fear this game as much as a Washington just based on how deadly those wide receivers were. I don't know. Am I wrong in that, or kind of do you feel a different vibe in this?
No, you're not fearing this team, not even comparing Arizona to Washington or anybody else. I don't think there's enough personnel on Arizona. Look, Jed Fish has done a really good job with what he has. I don't think there's enough personnel on this Arizona team that's going to like keep Kyle Whittingham up at night. I just don't think it's there. Kyle was very complimentary of Noah Fifita, as he generally is on quarterbacks that he thinks are good. And Kyle, you know, really likes Noah Fifita. You know, mentioned on Monday that, like, look, he doesn't have like the prototypical size, but he makes up for that with intangible stuff and you know, and smarts and IQ. And yeah, like Noah Fifita has been a revelation. You know, when James DeLora went to Arizona, I thought that was a very big deal based on what DeLora was able to do at Washington State previously. Had not panned out at Arizona for James DeLora the way that we all thought it would. He gets hurt, and here comes Fifita, and he's been awesome. You know, again, they're 7-3. Most of that coming with Fifita. They should probably be 8-2, 9-1. But no, this is not an Arizona team on either side of the ball where you have enough personnel where Utah should be, you know, like super nervous. I do think Utah is going to get this done in the desert, but I think it's going to be a street fight. That's what kind of Jed Fish, you know, that's what Jed Fish has sort of instilled, you know. And Jed Fish is, you know, a number of times since he took over has been like very complimentary of Kyle Whittingham and his program and what he's tried to do and the culture and the whole thing. And you're starting to see, you know, Arizona football, you know, long dormant, right? It's a basketball school, you know, first and forever. But like, you know, what Jed Fish has been able to do, you know, slowly like waking up this football program. You know, I don't know that they'll ever contend for a Big 12 title like beginning next year, but they're at least getting to a point under Jed Fish where, again, you can't just look at the schedule and say, oh, Arizona, like that's a win. Like you can't do that about Arizona anymore. And I think that's a credit because it's been a long, long road for Arizona football, but they're definitely trending in the right direction. And you see who they've beaten this year. Look, they beat Oregon State. They beat Washington State before Washington State completely went in the toilet.
I think, you know, they derailed their season, UCLA. Honestly.
What's up?
I think they derailed Washington State season,
honestly.
They might
have derailed Washington State. You're right. That's probably a better word. Beat UCLA. You know, not that that's a gigantic feat this season with what that quarterback situation has been, but these are things that Arizona was not doing under Kevin Sumlin and guys before that. So, been interesting to see Arizona's rise here. And look, if they can beat Utah, that's a gigantic feather in that program's cap. That's a huge, huge deal for Jed Fish if they can beat Utah. And look, that's not to take away the fact that they beat Oregon State, but if you can beat Utah, that's a big, big deal for Arizona football.
See, and I view this Arizona team as, and this is predates your time here at Utah, but I view this Arizona team as kind of Utah's 2017 team. They have a lot of the pieces that are going to be able to be good. They just don't have enough, right? And they don't have enough consistency. And so I think as you're starting to see this team grow, they very much so can be in that mix, right? Utah was in the mix for a Pac-12 championship in 2017. They just didn't have the depth to be able to compete. That's where Arizona is. They have talent. They have guys that can do it. They've got receivers. They've got running backs. They've got a line. They've got defense, whatever. They've got the culture even with Jed Fish, but I don't think they have enough. That, once again, that doesn't mean that they can't beat Utah. I think this team has proven that they are very good and that they can beat Utah. And I don't want to sit here and talk about Utah as some, you know, like Washington type team that they're undefeated and doing it. Like, this is a real possibility, but I think Utah has just shown over the last 5 to 7 years that they've been able to build to something better, that this now becomes incumbent upon Arizona to kind of look at Utah as a benchmark type of a team, right? You beat Utah, that turns into kind of like that solid win. So 2017, right. You look at it that way. This is where you're at. You're close, but not close enough. You know, you've got to take pride in that. My worry if I'm Arizona, though, is Jed Fish is going to be a hot commodity in this coaching carousel. You can't tell me that somebody like Texas A&M isn't going to go throw cash at somebody like him. And I don't know if he's in the in that mix, but you look at a Jonathan Smith or a Jed Fish, like two programs that have kind of built their programs in very similar ways to what Kyle Whittingham has done, and both have been very complimentary to Kyle Whittingham and kind of how he's done it. They've clearly done enough to be able to build it with areas that don't always recruit the best. If you can now do that in more fertile territories, like a you know, we don't know if Florida's going to come available, Florida, or you've got Texas A&M, or you've got some of these other Michigan, let's be real, Michigan might be in a situation here too. But like there's a lot of availability, and you know, you have to strike when the iron's hot. And so I wonder, you know, are these guys going to be out there for that? And that kind of hangs over people a little bit. I don't know. I don't think that's going to be a factor in this game. But I think if you're looking at the trajectory of this going into the Big 12 or with Oregon State going into the Mountain West, these have to be real concerns. And you have to worry that you're just another stepping stone team going into that. And I know Arizona doesn't want to be that, but there's a real possibility there with how valuable Jed Fish has become.
Yeah, Jonathan Smith, you know, now that we're on this topic, I mean, Jonathan Smith should be like a pretty hot commodity at this point, just given what he's done at Oregon State. But Jonathan Smith is an Oregon State alum, and who knows what his appetite is to leave. You know, of course, you could be making more money elsewhere, and, you know, you're not going to be playing for a national championship, let alone a conference championship at a place like Oregon State at this point. So, you know, among the Pac-12 coaches, guys who might leave or could leave for something else, Jonathan Smith to me is the most fascinating one, just because of his ties to Corvallis, his ties to the football program. And yeah, but he's a hell of a coach. And, you know, he's another guy, as you said, who has wanted to sort of model what he's doing based on Kyle Whittingham. You know, Jed Fish and Jonathan Smith and also Kenny Dillingham from Arizona State have all said very, very complimentary things about Kyle and the culture that he's built at Utah. So it's interesting to see that, you know, not only is Kyle essentially like, you know, the dean of Pac-12 coaches, but he's also like ascended to this point where, you know, you've gotten your program to the mountaintop now twice in winning the Pac-12, regularly competing to at least get to the Pac-12 championship game over the last half decade. And now these younger coaches coming into the league are looking around and they're like, we want to be like that guy. So that's kind of the, you know, not that Kyle's retiring yet, but like that's, you know, that's an interesting, important legacy that he's leaving, you know, among the younger coaches. It's interesting to watch.
Do you remember when Jed Fish took the job and he called his team the 33rd NFL team and people mocked him? And for good reason, right? Like it deserved mocking. Bad. But at the same time, what he was trying to do was trying to build a culture of this is the next stepping stone to an NFL, right? That's exactly the way that Kyle Whittingham's done it. He tries to model his way in an NFL-type system where he's going to give guys the best opportunity to succeed at the next level because they've already run kind of a very similar situation. It sounded crazy, but I understand where Jed Fish is coming from, right? Like I see him as somebody that is trying to build a culture there in a place that hasn't always had the culture in football. Basketball, you want to talk basketball, and it's a completely different experience, right? Like Arizona is elite in basketball, but that's the problem, is they are elite in basketball and they couldn't care less most years in football. Jed Fish cares, and he's gotten his players to care, and he's gotten recruits to care. It's not perfect, right? They're still close, but like I think you're starting to see something build. So to me, I think that's this interesting dynamic. This becomes that benchmark game for Arizona, as I've mentioned, where if you can beat Utah, you know, the two-time reigning Pac-12 champions, the one that has been in there for the last five seasons, if you're counting COVID, this is something you want to use as a badge of honor, especially if you're looking to be able to outclass the guy that you've been modeling your program after. So it's an important opportunity. That's why you can't take these games lightly. I don't think Utah's going to take this game lightly. I think that this absolutely has their attention. No game this season, I think, is ever one that Utah has kind of overlooked. Each game this season has just been kind of hit after hit after hit. Next week, you have to go against the Neon Deion effect, Coach Prime effect, whatever you want to call it. Even though they've lost some of its luster because of that, like every game is going to be tough. So this will be interesting.
Scale of 1 to 10. What are the odds that Kyle says anything useful to us media useful about Dion on Monday? Scale of 1 to 10.
It's going to be so like complimentary, and it's going to be so like he's done a good job of building a program. I want him to just like just say his true minds on what he thinks of Coach.
Well, we know Brian. He's not going to do that.
No, I know, but. It's, so I'm going to go with a 2. How about 2?
I'm hoping this is one of those things where, like, he won't give you the whole thing, but he'll, like, lead you down the path.
Oh, or please.
I would settle – you know what I would settle for? You remember last year before the first USC game when Kyle sort of went off on a tangent about, like, not USC specifically, but, like, NIL and how NIL is controlling college football, and eventually the top 25 teams will be the top 25 NIL bags of money, and we all kind of went with it. And the national guys aggregated it, some of them not responsibly, but I digress.
That happens never.
Never. I would settle for something like that. I need Kyle to say something about Dion.
I think somebody asked, like, early on when it was kind of the early phases of Coach Prime, like, what was going on. And he, you know, he punted it a little bit. But I agree. I want – if you're going to get something, that will be the way, right? Like, I could say, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, an 8, if it's that, like – back channel way,
right?
But it's
right.
Definitely a 2, where he's going to be complimentary. He's going to talk about
how good. I was going to say 3, but yeah,
okay, yeah. You know, he'll praise Shedeur Sanders, and he'll talk about how good sure. he is, and you know, and what Coach Prime has done for Colorado and the Boulder area. I mean, we could write the quote for him if he wants.
Another question.
Okay, I like this.
Does Dion know who Kyle Whittingham is? Ooh, and I, of course, he knows who he is.
No, but I know
he knows the person.
That's
but
a good
does he
question.
Know like about Utah football and what he's done and like the program that Kyle has put together? Like, does Dion know or care, frankly, who Kyle Whittingham is?
Outside of you know, coming in on Sunday morning, looking at who his next opponent is, I'm going to say no. I'm going to say that Coach Prime doesn't care or really know who Kyle Whittingham is. I mean, the reality is nobody knows who Kyle Whittingham is, and he's a 2-time reigning champion, and he's been considered for, you know, is it the Dodd Trophy? Is that the Coach of the Year award? I mean, like, he's been considered for these top awards, but he continues to be this underrated coach that – after they always beat USC, it always felt like, should we be considering Kyle Whittingham as the best coach? You know what I mean? Like, to me, that's where Kyle is always at, and he's fine with it, especially if his program is shining. And that 100%, you know, buys into Coach Prime and having no clue who Kyle Whittingham is outside of him just being a coach.
And I should clarify, like, I don't mean this as like a Dion versus Kyle Whittingham thing.
No.
I don't think Dion knows who any of the opposing coaches are. Like,
no.
Colorado
unless it's Nick Saban. Unless it's Nick Saban.
Colorado opened with TCU. TCU like just went to the national title game last year. I am very sure that Dion did not know who Sonny Dykes was.
No, absolutely.
During game prep, none.
I love that. That's a great question. The fact that like, and it's not like a conceited thing from Dion, right?
No,
like I think it's just that's the realm that he lives, right? Like he lives in just a 100%. Higher level where, you know, this is his first, you know, Power 5 opportunity, but he is talked about or looked at as the Nick Saban type celebrity, right? Like, Kirby Smart doesn't have that same celebrity as Deion Sanders, and for a good reason. Obviously, he played in the NFL and he played in MLB, and he has Deion Sanders. But I think that's what's so funny about it is he just operates in different circles, and it's kind of a fun game to play. So I don't know. I like that.
And then on the flip side of that, I'm just hoping that Brian Howell and, you know, the rest of the Colorado beat, like, does their job, and we get something good from Dion on Kyle.
I'll write that, too. I would like it. I mean, we need something. It's the last game of the season. We got to have something, right? Like,
again, I'm not asking for fireworks. I'm not expecting fireworks. I just, you know, just give me a little something, guys.
I can't, like, if Dion stays, and I have full intention on believing that he stays because I don't think he wants to leave, but, like, next year, if he can continue to build these recruits, that Colorado-Utah game, depending on whenever they play it, like, that could be, like, a solid game, right?
It would be – I think I said this, like, very early in the season, like, it would be a lot of fun if Utah-Colorado turned into a thing. Like, I've only been here for a few seasons, but like that game was just not a thing at all.
Never.
And like, you can't manufacture a rivalry. Like the Rumble in the Rockies, like that's, you know, that's real cute. That's real kitschy, but like you can't force a rivalry. It has to be organic. It has to be built from the ground up. Utah, Colorado is not a thing.
No.
If both these teams get good, as you said, if Dion stays, keeps with recruiting, if Kyle, you know, still has the fire and doesn't retire and Utah stays in contention, again, right, you know, depending on when the game is, it would be a lot of fun if Utah, Colorado, like, really turned into a thing.
I feel like that's where those fireworks, especially the passive aggressive fireworks from Kyle Whittingham, would get in there. You know, his comments like the "they have a Heisman, we have a pig farmer" type comment. That's what Kyle says. That's his fireworks. So,
that, yeah.
Which
they're forgot great. All about that.
They're great.
A lot has happened since that USC game. I forgot all about that.
Well, there has. It's been quite the season. So
it has.
I don't know. With that, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, there's always things that we could talk about, but I think that's kind of the gist going into this Arizona game. It's a tough opponent. They're going to be good on both sides of the ball. It's not scary in that respect, and that's not a disrespect to Arizona, but I think Utah approaches this game knowing that they can win, but they also know that this will be a rock fight, right? Like, this is 100% going to be one of those games that whoever has the ball last very well could win this game. So, or this turns into one of those games where it's like Utah fights back against Arizona State and absolutely destroys them. Who knows? Like, I'm open to anything, right. And as I say every week as we go into these, the vibes are weird. And it has been every single week outside of the Oregon game where Oregon was always going to beat them. You know, it's you can pick up on the vibes, and that's kind of my general sense this week. So,
yeah, I mean, I'll finish with this. I mean, there's not a giant basketball game tonight, but there's a game worth watching, right? Utah's going to play Wake Forest in the opening round of the Charleston Classic, and that's I don't even want to call it like a barometer type game for Utah, but it's like the first opportunity to play, you know, somebody real, Power Five opponent, not an upper echelon Power Five opponent, but it's a first opportunity to kind of really start to gauge what Utah is, what they could be. You know, the field in Charleston is strong. You know, if Utah wins tonight, you probably are playing Houston.
Yep.
I believe tomorrow is that semifinal. And on the opposite side of the bracket is Rick Pitino and St. John's. So you've got a bunch of opportunities here to kind of show who you are. So, you know, this game tonight, again, I would not call this a barometer game for Utah, but it is the first opportunity to like really like see what you have and like see what you are against somebody who is not UC Riverside, somebody who is not Eastern Washington.
I wrote kind of a preview to this game today that just barely published on KSL.com, and I called it kind of like tonight's game kind of the gateway to where they need to be, right? Like, this is where they need to go to be able to face a Houston team. And you're not expected to beat Houston, but you want to be in that game to be able to say that you played them. It's a good resume game.
Yep.
You're trying to build that. Right now, you know, all things considered, Utah has a good KenPom score. I think they're 35th.
39, I believe.
Something like that. Yeah. That's a good mark, right? Like, and obviously that's going to shift, and Utah's been kind of maybe not this high in early seasons before, but you want to be in this area, and if you can go against teams like a Wake Forest, which is 72, and you go against Houston, which is number 2 in KenPom, those things matter, and those are going to be able to help you build that resume. So although it's not like that game that's going to define your season, it is a way to kind of give you an early season check and at least understand what Craig Smith has, especially in the first year where you can arguably say that this is his roster.
Yes. Yes. And we should also say that Utah has played shorthanded through two games. They will play shorthanded again tonight. Will Exact has not played yet this season. There was a bit of a setback. Whatever injury he's dealing with. So he is in Charleston. I don't expect him to go tonight. And as of this morning, Thursday. Today's Thursday. As of early this morning, Thursday, the Davon Smith waiver decision has not come from the NCAA. Davon Smith is also in Charleston. So if that were to come, you know, this afternoon or whatever, he is ready to go if and when he is deemed eligible.
And I will say, if Davon becomes eligible, that is a huge game changer for Utah. I got Massive. To watch practice on Monday. Will was in there practicing a little bit. So, I mean, he is practicing with the team in limited reps. But then you have Davon Smith in there, and he's the closest comparison that I can make right now is he is kind of DeLon Wright. He's not quite as finished as DeLon Wright was and all that, but you're looking at that type of a game player who just understands, has great vision, he's got great passing. There's still things that he has to learn, and you can see it as he's in practice, but it absolutely changes Utah. And if anything, gives you another threat off the bench, eventually maybe potentially pushing Raleigh Wooster off, you know, if he can get to the level that they believe that he can be. I don't think that happens this year, but if you can get meaningful minutes from him, if he gets that waiver, this could be a good Utah team. And at the very least, they're going to be competing for a NCAA tournament. Whether they get there, I don't know, but at least you're maybe an NIT team.
At a minimum, Davon Smith being eligible and out there allows you to not have to run Raleigh into the ground.
Exactly.
Right. Playing 35 minutes, playing 36 minutes. Raleigh has like proven that he is capable of doing that on most nights, but you don't want to keep doing that. You would rather keep him fresh. And as you said, look, if you throw Davon Smith out there like today, you know, you're not getting everything from Davon Smith. If you can get 16, 18 really good minutes from Davon Smith, like initially, just to get his feet wet, it's not like an earth-shattering thing if Davon Smith is eligible, but it's a pretty significant thing for this Utah team because, again, backcourt depth, you don't have to run Worcester into the ground, and if you have that kid going, you alluded to this, you probably have a roster that is capable of at least like playing meaningful games into late February, into March. I don't know that they get to the NCAA tournament, but you at least believe that you can if Davon Smith is there.
Yeah, so check out that game tonight. Obviously, they'll play again on Friday, and then Saturday you've got the Arizona game. So we'll wrap that up today and call that it. And thanks for listening to us, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks.
Later, guys.